We are live, and I'm not sure how my connection is. I'm on the mobile right now because the internet here has died because of lockdown, and everyone is just crashing on the internet here in a country that already has really shitty internet to begin with. So anyway, I hope everyone is doing well. And Alexander, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Looking forward to Christmas week. My wife is vegan, so I insist on having my Christmas meal, a carnivorous Christmas meal before. So I had goose with Christmas pudding. And I noticed that somebody, when I mentioned it before, talked about gin. And of course, I did have some English gin. And that was on Saturday. And that was great. And I had a friend round, which is excellent. Because, of course, as I'm sure the world knows, on Saturday night, we went from midnight to tier four in terms of our lockdowns, which means that we're no longer able to meet our friends as we once did. So we just got that in time.
All right. Great. Great. Okay. Well, let's, because the internet here is all screwed up, let's just jump right into it. I hope everyone is doing well, and I hope my connection is good. My mobile connection, actually, in this case. But Alexander, we need to talk about Russia. So I think you want to first discuss.
Right. I'm afraid I missed some of that, Alex. We were going to discuss Russia.
Right. The Putin press conference.
That's right.
Discuss the Putin press conference. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, this is he usually does do a big press conference at the end of the year. And this is a sort of massive event in which all kinds of journalists from many places in the world come along and ask him questions. Usually there's a Western journalist who asks questions, as well as a German journalist. This time, the Western journalist was from the BBC. And the BBC asked him questions about the Navalny affair, and also asked him about whether Russia takes any blame, accepts any of the blame, and whether Putin himself accepts any of the blame for the deterioration in relations between Russia and the West. And he completely put, you know, the kibosh on that. He said Russia doesn't accept basically any blame at all. Every step it's taken has been a forced step. He talked, as he always does, about the domestic situation. That was far and away the greater part of the news conference. He talked about the difficult year that Russia has had, the same kind of problems that all the rest of the world has had with the pandemic, which we've discussed in many places. I found him optimistic and cheerful. He seemed to feel that the country had come through quite well, that its economy had only been pushed back a little, that, you know, there wasn't a huge recession, an explosion in unemployment, massive bankruptcies or anything of that kind. Governments had to borrow a bit more, but its reserves have increased, both its foreign currency reserves and its own domestic financial reserves. So overall, I thought he was in an optimistic mood. I would add, which he didn't touch on, but which people in the financial community have been talking about, is that this has been a boom year on the Russian stock market. Because Russia doesn't do QE or anything like that, this is in fact actual investors piling in and buying up stocks, not the central bank coming in and piling up buying stocks. And it seems that he sees that, and many people in Russia are seeing that as a sign that finally, with interest rates come down and with inflation under control, higher investment in the Russian economy is coming. So I thought he was overall pretty optimistic, pretty confident. There'd been some talk before that he'd been unwell, that he'd been suffering from Parkinson's and cancer and all that kind of thing. No sign of any of that, I have to say, in this news conference. So those are the general things. But I thought the most interesting part of the news conference, and the part of it that I think I'd like to focus on today, was relations with the United States. And he said a number of very interesting things. Firstly, he made it very clear that Russia is now definitely committed to economic self-sufficiency. In fact, he returned to that many times during his press conference. His basic view was that the way that Russia improves relations with the United States and with the West is by not becoming dependent on the West and the United States economically, so that it buys things on its own terms, it sells things on its own terms where it can, but that it doesn't rely upon Western imports, it doesn't rely upon Western capital, it borrows on its own domestic financial markets, which are now basically in a position to provide capital in that way. It's in effect, actually, when you unpack it and think about it closely, it is Donald Trump's MAGA policy applied to Russia, except, of course, that the Russians have taken it far further. And it's also pretty clear, by the way, that so economic self-sufficiency for Russia applies to China, too. I mean, it was very interesting the way he was talking about that, but Russia should be independent, it should be sovereign, it should build up its industrial base, rely on its own financial markets, not use Western credit institutions, not use Western credit cards, not use Western banks, all of those things, and certainly not build factories in other countries and import their products back into Russia in the way that the United States has done. I think that's actually quite interesting because, as I said, it's not been talked about very much, but in effect, as I said, it's a make Russia great again policy, not so very different from the kind of make America great again policy that Donald Trump was pursuing and wanted, of course, to pursue much further. That's the first thing. But the other thing was that he made it very clear that, you know, as Russia is going to pursue self-sufficiency, yes, it does want better relations with the United States. Won't be dictated to. It won't be put under any kind of pressure. It will only agree to that which it considers to be in its own interests. He was asked repeatedly about what he thinks about the Western information campaigns against Russia and about him personally. He just shrugged his shoulders, basically said, I don't care. And most interestingly of all, he talked about future relations with the Biden administration, and he actually seemed rather optimistic about them. He repeatedly said that, you know, Biden is an experienced politician, somebody whom the Russians know very well. You can interpret that as you will, and maybe we will discuss that more deeply. But he also said that he knows, the Russians know, all the people around Biden very well, they're very experienced too, that they have had many dealings with them. Again, you can interpret that as you will. And in fact, he seemed to think that actually, with the change of administrations, things might actually be easier for Russia than they have been up to now. He made it very clear that wasn't a criticism of Donald Trump personally, whom he clearly rather likes. But if anything, he seemed more relaxed about relations with the United States than I've ever seen him. Now, that may, of course, be, him being a bit of wishful thinking on his part. But, you know, it did make my eyebrows twirl up a little. He also talked about things like arms control, spoke about the fact that the West has been moving troops to Russia's borders. He talked about all of those things. He talked about cyber issues. He vigorously denied that Russia had actually hacked the DNC computers or anything like that in the 2016 election. But of course, all of that comes, in the context of this great hack that was supposedly carried out, supposedly by the Russians, on the US government, which we've been hearing so much about in the United States over the last week. He conspicuously did not discuss that, overall, though, as I said, an optimistic Putin, optimistic about the future of US-Russian relations, apparently looking forward to working with Joe Biden, who he knows very well. And of course, at the same time, quite clear that Russia needs to be self-sufficient.
Did you go over the BBC question?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Very. I mean, he was being very. I mean, the first thing was about Navalny, and, you know, he basically shot back. It was Steve Rosenberg, who is extremely well known here. Steve Rosenberg asked him about Navalny and about whether the Russians were going to investigate anything about Navalny. And Putin said, well, you know, how can we carry out an investigation? The Germans and the OPCW and the West say that Navalny was poisoned with Novichok, but the Germans won't provide us with any information and refer us to the OPCW, who they say they've given the information to. And we went to the OPCW and they tell us they can't share the information that because the Germans asked that it be kept confidential. So he said, you know, that's absolutely hopeless. And he asked Steve Rosenberg a rhetorical question about what do you think we should do in that about that. And Rosenberg actually seems to have been rather upset and offended that Putin actually asked him what was clearly a rhetorical question, not meant to be taken seriously. But anyway, that was Navalny. But the other thing was, Rosenberg, as I said, asked him again, do you accept that Russia is to blame in any way for the deterioration in relations between Russia and the West? Do you accept that you personally, Putin personally, are to blame in any way for deterioration of relations between Russia and the West? And Putin said, no, I don't accept that. It's the West that broke its promises after we withdrew from Eastern Europe. They said that NATO would not be moved eastward. It was moved eastward in breach of promises which were made to us. We see the United States embarking on an arms race. We see the US moving troops closer to our borders. So, of course, we have had to respond. And we had to respond also when coups were organized in places like Ukraine and elsewhere. So, you know, he gave absolutely no quarter on that one and put Rosenberg very much back in his box. It was Putin at his sharpest. And clearly, most, shall we say, least tolerant during the rest of the interview. I mean, he had many questions on domestic policies, which he dealt with in a far more relaxed way.
Yeah, but did you mention the best part of Putin's quote?
Well, tell me.
He said, if we really wanted to, I believe, did he say, if we really wanted to kill Navalny or poison Navalny, we would have done it?
Right, that was actually said in response to a question from a Russian journalist. It was not sent by Rosenberg, but he did. He absolutely
that was the quote. That was the quote of the
absolutely, absolutely,
of the presser.
Absolutely, and it was. I mean, he said. I mean,
it's true.
And it's true. I mean, it's true. I mean, you know, the idea that Russia can't murder someone on its own territory is just risible. He also said, by the way, that, you know, I mean, it's no secret that Navalny was under surveillance. This is in relation to the latest Bellingcat revelations. So where's the big deal in that? I would quickly add, by the way, I mean, this isn't, I mean, for those who are interested in Navalny and the Navalny affair, which I'm not, that the story constantly changes. I mean, firstly, he was poisoned with tea. Then he was poisoned with water in a water bottle in a hotel room. Then it was said that, you know, the poison was in his underpants. Then it was said that it was in a Negroni that he had at a bar a little before. All of this, of course, gets reported in Russia, and it's undermining whatever feelings most Russians had about this affair, because when a story constantly changes in that way, people stop believing anything that's said. And that's I think where Putin was coming from. But obviously, as I said, it's manifestly true. If the Russians had wanted to kill Navalny, they could have done it, and there's no question about that at all. And he quite rightly made that point. in response to a Russian to a question from, it wasn't actually, I think, a Russian journalist. It was a Russian rock singer who's turned opposition politician, who's now setting up his own media outlet.
Yeah, boy, if you go by the record of Bellingcat and all these propagandists, Russia probably has the worst track record of poisoning in the history of the world.
Absolutely.
But in the history of the world, they're probably the worst poisoners to have ever existed.
I mean, they're not only the worst poisoners and the most incompetent ones, but what is really remarkable is they persist in their own incompetence. I mean, going all the way back to Viktor Yushchenko, who was the president of Ukraine, who was supposedly poisoned by the Russians and had all sorts of, you know, spots appearing on his face. I mean, I've lost count of the number of people they're supposed to have poisoned and who then survive. And yet we are asked to believe that despite this dismal record, they persist in doing it. I mean, you know, what was it, you know, about, you know, doing the same thing again and again and again and expecting a different result? So, I mean, either their poisons aren't, you know, cracked up to be very much, or they're obviously stupid and incompetent about that. I mean, the whole idea is just ridiculous. I mean, clearly this poisoning thing has little real logic behind it, and as you rightly said, it's bizarre that so many people have been targeted have survived. I would add, by the way, that the Sunday Times, which is a British newspaper, even alleged that Navalny hadn't been poisoned once, but that he'd actually been poisoned twice, once with poison on his underpants, and then a second time when he was in a coma in the hospital in Omsk. And yet he seems to have survived on both occasions.
So, okay.
and not just survived, but seems to be rather well, actually. I mean, he's giving interviews all over the place.
Yeah, right. Okay, so Russia did it.
Russia.
Yeah, Bellingcat is now being trotted out to say that they've combed through thousands of phone calls and documents and records, and they could prove that it was the Russians that really did poison Navalny.
Yeah.
Because when it comes to investigating, much like the Russians have the worst track record on poisoning, Bellingcat has the best track record on investigative journalism and investigations in general, because Bellingcat actually goes to the places that the crime has happened. They actually do a forensic analysis. Mm. They're on the ground. They're studying everything. They're experts in all that they do, whether it's dealing with MH17 or whether it's dealing with poisonings. I mean, they have medical experts for the poisonings. They have crash experts and aeronautics experts for the planes. And they actually go to the location and they interview eyewitnesses and they go on the ground, on the scene, and they take samples of the poisoning or they take parts of the airplane and they study them and they do all their due diligence to come to these conclusions. Of course, everyone, I'm being 100% absolutely sarcastic here, but I just want to give a picture as to how the Russians are terrible at poisoning. But Bellingcat, my God, when it comes to investigating, they do a perfect job from some apartment in London.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I don't know that they're in London, by the way, but certainly in England. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, and by the way, on that subject, on that latest Bellingcat report, it's very interesting because basically what Putin said about, you know, the Bellingcat allegations that that Navalny had been under surveillance, that had been followed by FSB agency. FSB is the Russian counterintelligence agency. I mean, he basically admitted that. He said, you know, this, you know, it's obvious that someone like Navalny, the FSB, would be keeping an eye on him and that those people were following him. But what he was basically saying is that these people didn't make any great effort to conceal that, to conceal themselves. I'm sure that's true. I mean, Navalny himself will have known that he's under surveillance, so why bother to make a secret of it? But the way in which Bellingcat claims to have tracked these people through mobile phone records and all of that strongly implies that Bellingcat is getting help from an intelligence agency. Now, of course, Bellingcat consistently denies this. They consistently claim that they're getting their information independently. The Russians are saying on this one, that's impossible. This kind of information could only have been provided to Bellingcat by an intelligence agency. Well, that's what Putin is saying. That's what the Russians generally are saying. They're not denying that Navalny was under surveillance and was being followed, but they do emphatically deny that they poisoned him. And of course, the fact that he was under surveillance and being followed doesn't mean that they poisoned him. The one, as lawyers, the allegation that, you know, the poisoning is a product of the surveillance is, lawyers would say, well, it just doesn't follow. It's a non sequitur.
All right. And welcome, Spartan Warrior Queen. I see you in the live stream. Good to have you here moderating. And Alexander, okay, so let's forget about all of that stuff now.
Yeah.
Don Putin gave a good presser. Interesting comments. Mm. Let's move on now to, I think, the big show. And it really is a show, and that is this latest cyber attack, where once again it is being blamed on Russia. Mike Pompeo gave an interview, and he said, and I quote, it's pretty clearly it's Russia. Pretty clearly it's Russia. Interesting choice of words. U.S. President Trump tweeted the other day, and he said he has seen the intelligence. He's seen the report, and he says everyone is making a big stink over this Russian hack. He said he's seen it. It's not a big deal, which I think is really interesting, because Trump also said in the follow-up tweet, he said that everyone is the mainstream media and the Democrats and the swamp, they're all going crazy over Russia. Russia hacked us. We have to retaliate. We have to go to war. World War III, this is, you know, an attack on our democracy. Of course, the same old stuff they said in 2016. Trump said they're going crazy about this because they don't want to take a look at China. Because if you look at the past week, all the information we've gotten about China, whether it's been China, or, you know, like a list of 2 million spies or operatives working in the U.S., Canada, Europe, Australia, or whether it's Hunter, Jim, and Joe's connection to China. Trump is basically saying, everyone, look at Russia, but just don't look over there at China. That's the distraction. And I think that Trump is 100% correct. I also think, in closing, that much of this cyber attack is just being used as an excuse in order to add on more surveillance, because I think this is also a part of the Great Reset and part of the globalist plan to tack on a lot more surveillance systems onto the population. So now they're saying there's been this massive cyber attack. And I actually think Klaus Schwab talked about this, and he says we have to have a massive cyber attack in order to beef up our surveillance systems. So I think they're killing two birds with one stone here.
Yes. They're also perhaps killing a third bird, in the sense that I think that part of this, the talking up of this story, may be intended to head off any ideas of pardoning Edward Snowden. I say that because I've been seeing a whole lot of a swathe of articles appearing, especially in establishment Republican outlets like National Review, which are basically saying that under no circumstances should Donald Trump pardon Edward Snowden, and actually misrepresenting key facts about Edward Snowden's case, making out again that Edward Snowden was somehow a Russian agent or a Russian spy who fled to Moscow, which isn't true at all. He didn't want to go to Moscow. He was intending to fly to Ecuador, but the airplane that was supposed to take him there was blocked, and that prevented him leaving Moscow. So he was basically trapped there. But I've seen a lot of stories like that, and I think this talking up of this incident, of this hack, looks to me very much like this. Now, first of all, let's get back to what Trump actually said, because he's the president of the United States. He gets briefed about all of these things. He's been briefed by Radcliffe, and I presume by Gina Haspel and all those people. And he gets the daily brief, the president's daily brief that's put together for him. So he will know. He will actually have knowledge. He says two things about this. Firstly, that this wasn't as big a deal as is being made out. I mean, this talk about it being some kind of cyber Pearl Harbor is wildly exaggerated. That's one. And the second thing is that there is actually no confirmation yet about who carried out this hack. Now, on the second, we know that one country has previously carried out a very extensive hack of the US government. That country wasn't Russia. It was actually China. And it happened in 2015 when, of course, Barack Obama was president. And the US did actually very little about it then. I mean, they didn't really complain very much or say very much. But this looks a little bit like a repeat of that incident. Now, I'm not saying that proves it was China that did this hack. Clearly, no one knows. But if you want to talk about someone who's done this before, the Chinese have done it. The Russians, apparently, on this scale, have not. Perhaps the Chinese have resources that the Russians don't have, or perhaps the Russians have those resources and haven't used them, or perhaps it was the Russians. I don't know one way or the other, but clearly no one knows, and China must be a possibility. So it's interesting, again, that Pompeo and, by the way, Adam Schiff and all those people are back to blaming Russia for this incident and seem to be playing it up and making it sound like it was a bigger deal than it really was. And I agree. It seems to me there are multiple agendas. One, as I said, was Snowden. Another is to divert attention from China, as you rightly said. And a third, it seems to me, is to increase pressure on Biden to be tough on China, on Russia, when he becomes president. It's interesting, by the way, that Biden is saying very, very little about this affair, just as actually he said very, very little about Russia since the election. So I think it's multiple agendas being followed, but clearly somebody is busy talking this up to the extent to the greatest possibility that they can and making it look worse than it probably is and pointing at Russia when there really isn't any evidence and when the history would suggest that it's more likely to have been China. I'm going to add one last point, which is, of course, this looks like espionage. Everybody does espionage. The United States does it. The United States obviously hacks into the computers of its rivals. I said that back in 2015, when the Chinese hacked the US government, there wasn't very much criticism. If you actually reel back to that time, one person actually said that he was very, very impressed by the skill the Chinese had used to hack the US government. This is back in 2015. And he wished the US had that same capability to bring to bear against China. In other words, he was admiring of the Chinese hack. That person was James Clapper, who was at that time Obama's Director of National Intelligence. So that gives you an idea, firstly, how very differently they react to what China does from the way that from Russia, how very differently the Obama administration reacted to a big Chinese hack than, you know, we're all this talk about a cyber Pearl Harbor when it comes to Russia. And it also tells you that this sort of thing goes on all the time.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out why they're doing it now. Why have they decided to trot this out now? Because obviously this is, it's so perfect because no one can really know if there really was a hack or not. And no one can really confirm if it was Russia, China, Iran, or whoever, or Germany, or Israel, or God knows who, or nobody, or the US government itself. or well, Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum. Bill Gates. No one knows who the hell hacked, if there even was a hack. So there's a reason why they're bringing it up now, about a month, not even 2 weeks before January 6th, you know, 4 weeks before January 20th. You know, Putin gives his press conference. He pretty much, Putin is a spy. He's a head intelligence guy. He understands spycraft better than any world leader out there. And so when Putin sits there and he says, you know, I look forward to working with Joe Biden because I understand Joe Biden, he's basically saying, I've got just about all the dirt I need on the guy. So I'm pretty happy about that. I mean, it's as clear as day what he's hinting at.
Absolutely.
But, you know, Russia's tied to China.
Yeah.
Biden is compromised by Russia and China. Trump, though he said many good things about China and Russia, that he wants to work with them, he's gone hard after China. Not per se after China, but he's gone hard to push his America First policy out there, which runs counter to what China wants.
Yeah.
It seems that, you know, I'm just trying to figure out the main winner in all of this. And the deep state, of course, is obviously tied into China for some reason. The Democrats, we know, if you go by Eric Swalwell, they're very, very tied into China. If you go by Eric Swalwell, if you know what I mean, China just seems to, they seem to have the leverage here outside of, as long as they can get Trump out, they seem to have the leverage here. Even leverage on Russia. I mean,
oh yes. I mean, this is actually talking about leverage. Chinese leverage on Russia. I mean, Putin made it. You know, said, you know, see, you know, I speak regularly with Xi Jinping. I have lots of contacts with him. He is my friend. But when he talks about economic self-sufficiency, obviously that's partly addressed to the West, which is, in fact, it's mainly addressed to the West. But you can also see that it's a way of referring to China too. I mean, not to become dependent on anyone, not on the West, as Russia became dependent on the West in the 1990s and early 2000s. But obviously not dependent on China either. He seems to believe, in fact, he clearly believes, that that's the way to build stable long-term relationships. You are independent, you are strong. That way, you're able to cut deals which are in your interests as well as the other parties. That's what Donald Trump also thinks, by the way. So, and by the way, I would add that's absolutely what Xi Jinping thinks. The people who don't seem to think like that are many people in the Democratic Party in the United States who seem to think that the United States needs to integrate itself and its economy and submerge its economy in this great globalist system, so that basically anybody and everybody has leverage over them, which is really, really rather strange. But then, of course, as we remember when we discussed General Mattis, American generals of that stamp don't think that, you know, making America great again and America first is a correct policy for the United States. Very strange outlook that we have in the United States on the part of some people at the moment. But absolutely, clearly, the Chinese have great leverage on the United States. Clearly, they have great leverage over Russia. The United States under Donald Trump was taking some steps to reduce that leverage. As you absolutely rightly say, Donald Trump seems to be the only political leader who is concerned about that. We're getting nothing like that from the Biden people. In Russia, which is friends with China at the moment, they are concerned clearly too to reduce Chinese leverage over them. So Donald Trump wants to reduce US leverage, Chinese leverage over the US. Vladimir Putin, who's a friend and ally of China, wants to reduce Chinese leverage over Russia. Some people in the United States clearly are not concerned about it.
It's interesting that they mentioned Iran as well. Is this also a signal to Biden? The deep state or not, or they're just lumping in Iran just to create the impression of, you know, going back to George Bush, an axis, another axis of evil, so to speak. But more Russia, Iran, and they don't want it. That's the interesting part. They don't want China. I mean, from what I understand, Ratcliffe wants China listed.
Yes.
As a country that was partaking in the attack. But the swamp doesn't want China listed. This is the weird thing about it all. It seems like they want the axis of evil to be Russia and Iran.
Yes.
And China, you know, a little bit China, just a little bit.
Yeah, but I mean,
it doesn't make any sense, you know, why they avoid putting China into this new axis of evil that the swamp has fabricated.
It's very bizarre. It's like, you know, going all the way back to the 1990s and even before, actually, all the way back to Nixon and Kissinger, back, you know, going to Beijing, you know, China is your partner. China is your the country that you're going to work with. You play the China card. It seems as if all that's happened in the 30 years, the 50 years since the 70s, it's just not happened as far as these people are concerned, that China is still the same country that it was, well, let's say in Bill Clinton's time, or indeed even in Barack Obama's time, that we can go back and working with the Chinese, that we can have good relations with the Chinese, that, you know, the Chinese can continue to provide us with all the cheap goods, which will keep our own inflation rates low and our GDP rising, that we'll be able to financialize the economy more, that Steve, you know, the likes of Steve Jobs and the other tech companies will be able to go on building their factories in China, that Elon Musk will be able to build his Tesla factories in China. They seem to want to go back to that world. It's as if any real concerns about China have been wished away. And yes, we will you know, try to prevent US allies in the Pacific, you know, from peeling off and realigning with China. But the way we're going to do that is by opening even further our markets to their goods. So we'll be flooded by goods from China, and we'll also be flooded by goods from Indonesia and the Philippines and Vietnam and Malaysia and all those other places too. It's a very strange mindset. And of course, we come back to some of the things that we've discussed on previous programs, and which you, Alex, specifically raised, that one can't help but think that what underpins this wishful thinking is some people's very, very strong personal financial interests. So tech companies, which, you know, support the Democrats, we've seen how important their support is. They want to maintain their relationship with China because they, you know, have their factories there, even though China blocks them, which Russia doesn't do, by the way. Wall Street financiers do very well out of the fact, you know, that China provides all these cheap goods and hollows out American industries. So, you know, they're happy about that. And as we've seen with the Hunter Biden affair, all sorts of people within the Beltway, within Washington itself, within the swamp, they're very happy to have things continue with China as before, because they were personally doing very well out of it. So it does look as if financial motivations are, you know, underpinning this whole thing. And over and above and all, on top of all of that, since we can't really criticize the Chinese because we want to be friends with them in spite of what they're doing to us, we want to double down on the people that, you know, we don't like, primarily, first and foremost, of course, that's the Russians, because, you know, the Russians are, you know, they're a military challenge and all that, but, you know, we don't really trade with them. They don't have the same kind of economy that China has. So, you know, it's pretty painless to be really horrid to the Russians, because we don't lose anything personally by doing that. Of course, if you're German or you're French, you know, that's different, but then we don't really care very much about, you know, German business people and those sorts of people. So, you know, we've doubled down on being horrid to the Germans, to the Russians. And of course, Iran too, even though I frankly don't believe that Iran carried out this hack. I think this is way beyond their resources. But, you know, we don't really want a Biden administration cozying up too much to Iran, because our priority is to start new regime change campaigns in the Middle East, and Iran to some extent gets in our way. So, you know, lump together Iran and Russia, a new axis of evil, cozy up to Beijing, open your doors to Beijing, open your doors to all the other Asian competitors, continue to do very well with yourself, and forget about what is happening in places like, well, dare I say it, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio.
Yeah, a complete distraction. But is that the ultimate goal in all of this, by saying Russia and Iran? Is the ultimate goal to say, you know what, come January 20, as the deep state, this is what the deep state is thinking, and the Democrats, we're going to have Sleepy Joe in the White House. We'll get rid of him slowly, slowly, or maybe quickly, quickly. Who knows? At this point, we'll have, you know, empty suit Kamala Harris as president. And we're going to go back to the Obama days. And we're prepping the public. We're prepping the public with this cyber attack, which may have not even happened.
Yes.
No one even knows. We're prepping the public once again to say Russia evil, Iran evil. China, we're not going to focus on China. All good there. Globalism good. China good, globalism super, your World Economic Forum super, Paris Accord super, all of that stuff great. So we're going to now start color revolutions in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe, because that's where the enemy lies, i.e. that's where Iran is, and that's where Russia is. But the Iran thing is a little bit interesting, because it is the Obama administration that did have the JCPOA. So that's the one part that I'm trying to kind of wrap my head around. The Russia, I understand.
Yes.
I understand that they want to paint Russia as the enemy so they can start going into Syria.
Yes.
Meddling around in Belarus. Yes. Meddling around once again in, God knows where, Moldova perhaps. Ukraine. No, it's a possibility. Absolutely. Transnistria, all that stuff.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I think obviously the Russians are set up as the stage villain. Russia bad, Iran pretty bad, but I suspect there is tension within the Biden team over this. As I said, there's some of the hardline neocons there, or liberal interventionists. I don't think there's very much difference. Want to continue a hardline policy against Iran, because, as I said, they get in the way. The Iranians get in the way of the regime change agenda in much of the Middle East. I mean, they supported the Syrian government, for example. They support the present Iraqi government, for example. They are involved in other places in the Middle East where the United States and the neocons and neoliberals also want to be involved. So there is that anti-Iranian aspect. But against that, there are other people within the Biden team who want to go back to the kind of arrangements that Obama had with Iran. Obama saw the JCPOA as the crowning foreign policy achievement of his presidency. I think there are still some people in the Biden team who hanker after returning to that. They don't like the Saudis. They don't like the Gulf states. They don't like Egypt or these countries, the US's traditional allies in the Middle East. They're not, by the way, too keen on Israel either. Obama, remember, had a terrible relationship with Netanyahu. So, you know, we continue with regime change, but we try and make up and be friends with Iran and not with our old traditional allies in the Middle East. So I suspect there's that sort of tension there. So Russia, very bad. Iran, perhaps bad, perhaps not. China, not so bad. In fact, possibly our partner and friend. I mean, that seems to be, if I can say it, the sort of general, the general philosophy, and at the same time, as you rightly said, reintegrate with all the globalist institutions, become involved again with the Paris climate change policies, integrate yourself with all of those other things, forget about the US industrial base, because that's ultimately not what you're concerned about anymore. And, you know, let Elon Musk and Apple build their factories in China.
Is would you say that Russia is Russia? Do you think Putin's a globalist?
No, no, I don't think so. I think what Putin is what the Germans call a national liberal. That is to say, he believes in an economy which operates on the basis of supply and demand, where the markets set prices, but which operates as a sovereigntist state. If you want to get the closest analogy to that, in the United States, look to the kind of policies that were inaugurated by Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War or during the Civil War, and which continued to be operated in the United States right up until the 50s. In other words, a system where, you know, you have high protective tariffs, you foster your own industry. The government does have some involvement. I mean, like, you know, Eisenhower building all the you know, all the great roads across the United States, all that sort of thing, all that infrastructure. But at the same time, it's an economy run by the market, decided by the market. Prices are run by the market, and you provide a great deal of help to small and medium-sized industries, what the SMEs, as some people call them, and which, to which, by the way, Putin devoted a great deal of time in his press conference. So that's what I think he is. Well, as I say, what the Germans call a national liberal, a kind of policy that was actually very, very common in the United States. I mean, almost universally accepted in the United States before the Second World War, and to a great extent, right up until the 50s. The policy, by the way, which made the United States strong, a philosophy that is to some extent identified in the United States with Alexander Hamilton, though I think that's a more, I think it's a more complicated thing than that. But anyway, that kind of policy, I think that's what Putin is all about. Globalism, as he has made very, very clear, is something that he is strongly opposed to. After all, he talks all the time now about the importance of self-sufficiency. Globalists do not talk about self-sufficiency. The person, of course, who is the great advocate of globalism, even though he doesn't believe in it, the person who comes to Davos and goes on and talks about what a great thing globalism is, the political leader who does that is China's Xi Jinping. If you actually go to China, you would know what a false thing that is, how China pursues an absolutely opposite policy within its own country. But the Chinese publicly espouse it. The Russians don't.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Xi Jinping in China. I agree. Globalism helps them, no doubt about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
That's not in their country.
No,
it's not country. In their country. Globalism it, everywhere else, but just don't bring it in here. That's the way they work it. It's pretty clever.
Globalism for export only. that's the sort of Chinese philosophy. And frankly, I mean, you know, let's be straightforward about this. If other people are suckers, I mean, you know, and fall for this from the Chinese, can you blame the Chinese? I mean, it seems to me, blame people in the United States, blame Democrats, blame the tech companies, blame those kind of people who seem to like this thing and who want to believe what Xi Jinping is saying. Xi Jinping is pursuing his own agenda, which works for him, and as he would say, for China too. I mean, that's, if it works, you know, why change it? It's, you know, if other people are fools and play your game for you, well, you know, why change your game? Why start changing what you say. But it's Xi Jinping, it's the Chinese media that talk about what a great thing globalism is. In Russia, on the contrary, they are not just skeptical about it, they are downright hostile to it. And by the way, and with reference to a recent piece in the New York Times, there is even a school of thought in Russia which says if there is such a thing as climate change, then bring it on. Because what that will mean is that vast regions of our country, which are under permafrost, will become fertile and can be populated. We can increase agricultural production even further. We can start becoming even richer than we were previously. And we can open the Northern Sea routes, which would be an alternative to the Pacific routes, but which would be shorter between Asia and Europe, and which we would control. So, and of course, you know, all the oil and gas in the Arctic, which is locked away, we can exploit it even more easily. So there are some Russians who say about climate change, if it exists, bring it on. We actually like it. So that gives the Russians, obviously, a different perspective to climate change than you would find, you know, the Gretas and people like that having. Of course, I'm not going to enter into a debate about the science of climate change, which I don't understand and I have no views about.
All right. Well, I like Russia's attitude towards it. Just bring it on. It's just going to help us. But they hate Trump in much the same way they hate Vladimir Putin. Well, yeah. I mean, the neoliberals, the mainstream media, the neocons, Hollywood, you name it. Anyway, the whole neocon, neoliberal, elitist, globalist.
Indeed.
Pack. Why? Why do they hate Putin in the same way that they hate Trump?
Well, to some extent, we've already identified the reason. Trump is an anti-globalist. Putin is an anti-globalist. Putin is a straightforward anti-globalist. I mean, he's even said that liberalism is a exhausted and out-of-date ideology. He actually said that in an interview with the Financial Times, which created uproar, by the way, in Britain, and is still being cited and, you know, to prove what a evil authoritarian man Putin is. So Putin is an anti-globalist. Donald Trump is an anti-globalist. They each believe in their somewhat different, but not so different ways in making America great again, make Russia great again, America first, Russia first, pursue self-sufficiency, rebuild your industrial base, reverse integration into the West's, in Russia's case, into the West's financial structures, keep a distance from China. That sort of thing. Of course, the globalists loathe all of that. And then, of course, Mr. Xi comes along from Beijing. He tells them, globalism, great, bring it on. I love it. It's just what I believe in. And of course, that for that reason, they hate him less, even though in reality, what he does in China, he's doing the opposite.
Why do they hate Russia?
Well, I think lots of reasons.
Outside of Putin. Okay, they hate Putin, there's no doubt. But why do they hate Russia? Why is Russia always the enemy? And why does Russia always put up with this?
Right. Very good question. I mean, I think firstly, what it all goes back to is what happened in the late 1990s, early 2000s. I think, as I said, if you're pursuing a globalist agenda, which is they were, they look at Russia, they say, what does Russia have? It has lots of oil, lots of gas. We want it to supply us with all that oil and gas. We want our companies going into Russia, extracting it. We don't want Russia to be a great power again. We don't want Russia to be a military power again. We don't want Russia to be an independent power, because if they are independent, well, they might get all sorts of ideas about closing our access to their oil and gas. And of course, that's exactly what Russia did in the early 2000s. It reversed the policies of the 1990s. It reasserted its control of its natural resources. It blocked Western companies from investing directly in Russian oil and gas fields. They can only do so with Russian partners under Russian state supervision. They also blocked, by the way, Western banks from establishing themselves in Russia. Again, if Western banks want to establish themselves in Russia, they have to be regulated by the Russian central bank. So they did all of those things. They opted out, in other words, from globalization. This is even before the word globalization was used. And I think there's been huge anger about all of this because there was all that massive investment by people doing what they could to try and control the political system in Russia in the 1990s. And also lots of people going to Russia, making lots of money and anticipating that they were going to make even more money when the Russian economy opened up to them. And now they're incredibly angry that that has reversed course. And they also see Russia again reasserting itself increasingly in what it calls its near abroad, the countries around the Soviet Union, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. And you know, we've talked about what happened in the Southern Caucasus. We've talked about what happened in Belarus, where the color revolution there that was tried there over the last few months has run out of steam and appears to have failed. So there's all of that about the Russians, and it makes them in the West extremely angry. And why do the Russians put up with it? I'm going to say very straightforwardly why. Up till very recently, to some extent, still now, they felt weaker. They felt that they were too weak to push back hard. I mean, Putin actually talks a lot in the press conference about the state of Russia when he took over an economy in chaos, a military that had completely collapsed. He said that when he became president of Russia, he found that out of a military that numbered millions of men, only 50,000 were effective. A country whose industries had basically failed, that was becoming a complete oil dependency. So they felt very weak. And at the same time as they were trying to reassert themselves domestically, they felt that they had to accept an awful lot from the West and put up with an awful lot. And that's, I think, where it came from. I think they still feel increasingly, they still feel to some extent that they're in a weak position. And as I said, they don't want to get too close to China either. But it was interesting that Putin, as I said, responded back and was so critical to Steve Rosenberg from the BBC. And I noticed that for the first time, he stopped talking about Western countries as their part, as Russia's partners. He even at one point referred to them as our adversaries. So, you know, we're perhaps starting to see a trend moving towards a harder line. I ought to quickly add, since we're talking about Putin, that he left open the question of whether he will stand again in 2024. My impression is that he's edging towards a decision not to. That was the impression I got from this news conference. And I suspect that whoever succeeds him will take a harder line than he has done, because he came in at a time when Russia was weak. His successor will come to power at a time when Russia is a lot stronger. And of course, he was talking a lot about hypersonic weapons, about how Russia has practically ended its oil dependency. The budget now is no longer dependent on oil. 70% of it comes from non-oil sources, all kinds of things of that kind. So I think they're feeling stronger than they were, but I think they're still perhaps feeling less strong than they need to be.
Why did they prevent Donald Trump from any kind of rapprochement with Russia?
Who, the Russians or the U.S.?
The deep state, the U.S.
Oh, the deep state, I think, still
they made it a priority.
Yeah, they made it
an priority. They made zero good relations with.
They made it an absolute priority because they've identified Putin as the enemy, and they still have this idea that if you can overthrow Putin, you can bring someone like Navalny and make Navalny president of Russia, at which point you revert to the kind of policies that you had with Russia in the 1990s. And then who knows, if you want to really put pressure on China in the future, well, then you've got Russia on side and China isn't getting all those resources from Russia anymore. I think that was largely what it was all about. Brennan, before the election, actually tweeted that the ideal situation for him was Biden president in the US, Navalny president in Russia. Not going to happen, but that's what he tweeted.
And Navalny has zero chance of being
zero chance.
Mayor of the smallest town in Russia. He's got zero chance.
Zero chance. Even with all the, well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, all that Western backing he gets actually turns Russian public opinion against him. And this is something I think that people like Brennan don't understand. By the way, I mean, I ought to say something, which is about US intelligence agencies, that they are not fit for purpose. The US intelligence agencies don't understand China very well. I mean, they've been asleep. This Chinese power has grown to, you know, dizzying levels. And they don't understand Russia very well. I mean, if they really think that Navalny is a good investment, then they've completely miscalculated. I mean, it's a complete misjudgment of the direction the country is going.
Yeah. All right. Well, is there anything else you want to talk about from the cyber attack or the Putin press conference? I mean, another interesting thing about Russia, which I don't want to hit on the medical side of things. It's interesting how they're approaching their own vaccine policy as well. I think that also shows how they've checked out of the global game in a way, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I should, by the way, say something, which is I actually had a call from someone in Moscow, and they were telling me, this is a Western person in Moscow, that in fact, it's very relaxed there at the moment, despite all, you know, the pandemic seems to have stabilized, and they were able to go to the cinema and do things which, of course, here in London, we simply can't do. They are taking their own approach line. They're taking their own approach line restrictions, and they're taking their own line now about rolling out, you know, their own vaccines, which, by the way, are much simpler than Western vaccines are. Now, I'm not going to talk about their effectiveness because I have no knowledge or understanding of that issue.
No, but once again, if I could just jump in there, Alexander, once again, it's really interesting because it shows the conservative traditional approach once again. Yes. Of a country like Russia, even in the way they developed their shot.
Absolutely.
They just went back to the way it's always been done.
Absolutely,
and
correct.
Just, and they're just using the same approach, and they're using their own common sense to deal with it, and they don't want any outside interference. No. While in the West, you have all this new technology this software that's embedded in the shot and all that stuff. I mean, it's like Russia, once again, it showed its conservative, traditional approach to things in a way.
That is profoundly true. In fact, that's one of the things I have to say when you read Russian commentaries about these things. It's like, you know, going back to the world of, you know, Ronald Reagan and the world, the world before globalization. I mean, it's very practical, very straightforward. None of these sort of, you know, tremendous philosophical debates we have about, you know, and certainly none of these bizarre technologies and curious things. Do it in a very simple way, based on laboratories, technicians, no vast companies, no, you know, sweeping things all over the place. It's completely different. And I have to say, much more relaxed, ultimately. It doesn't have this sort of edginess that we have here, because it's so simple and so straightforward.
Do they have a Bill Gates type character?
There is no one like that. They have some very advanced tech companies. I mean, if
no, but I mean like a Bill Gates type oligarch that's on TV 24/7.
I don't think that possibility exists. Firstly, that there should be such a person, and secondly, that such a person would ever be allowed that kind of media coverage in Russia that there is in the West. No, the answer is there is nothing like that. I mean, you know, we talk about oligarchs, Russian oligarchs. The reality is that if you're talking about private business people, there's just no competition. You know, the Bill Gateses, the Elon Musks, Jeff Bezoses, all these people. Exactly. I mean, they are far more prominent in the U.S. They play a far more active role in politics in the U.S., informing opinion in the U.S. than anybody in business does in Russia. In the 90s and early 2000s, it was different. Then it was fully legitimate to talk about oligarchs then. But there's absolutely nothing like that. And there's no, as I said, big tech oligarchs or anything like that coming along, and pontificating in the way that we see in the United States. And by the way, in Britain too.
Yeah, we'll get to the super trust right now, but I just want to give you one final question since you're talking about the oligarchs, because it's a question we kind of get asked about a lot. And I think that's the fact that I want you to comment on this. I think Putin's approach when he first took office was very different than what we see in the West, in that he basically, and I'm being very simple in how I explain it and what I know about it, he basically gave the oligarchs an option, one of two things. Either you're with me in the government in what we're going to do, and he's put some of these guys in his cabinet or as advisors, so to speak. He doesn't hide it. No. So either you're with me or get the hell out of the country. I'm not going to go after you. I'm not going to whatever. Just get out and just don't come back in. So take all your money, get the hell out of here. Or you're with me and you're with the government and you're going to be amazingly rich, maybe a little less rich. Instead of 10 billion, you'll have 8 billion. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But you're also going to play ball with the government. In other words, you're not going to try to govern us. You're going to be a partner in a way with us instead of trying to subvert or undermine us, like the way a Zuckerberg or Google or Bezos tries to undermine, you know, a Trump administration. You know, he kind of played that game with them, and I think it worked. I mean, I think the situation now, I don't know if it's the same now, but back as he was getting Russia out of the depths that that it found itself in, I think it worked really well.
Absolutely. That's exactly what he did. That is exactly, there was even a meeting where he basically said that to all of them. He said, look, you either play with me and with Russia, or you don't, in which case you go. And one or two oligarchs, Khodorkovsky in particular, didn't take him seriously, and they ended up in prison. So that's what he did. And the result is that in Russia, the people who hold power in Russia, apart from Putin himself, who exercise political power and make decisions, are those people who are elected to office, or who, if you don't believe in the integrity of Russian elections, at least who are part of the political system. It's politicians and political leaders who make the decisions, and the structure of government is as it appears to be. So you know what role the president has, you know what role the prime minister has, you know what role the finance minister has. They are all the people who, you know, you could go to, and you know that they've got the power to make the decisions. In the West, it isn't like that anymore, because we've got everything scrambled, because we have people like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and all the others who exercise enormous amounts of political power. But they do so outside the traditional political structures. And that's the fundamental difference between what happened in Russia and what happened in the West. Russia was going that way. In fact, it was there to an even greater extent than the US is, but it reversed course. When Putin came along, he said, this is intolerable, it's unacceptable, it cannot but continue. You're a businessman. As a businessman, you stick to business. If you want to give advice, you give advice, but you do so confidentially and in private, and you don't involve yourself publicly in politics. If you want to do that, then you stop being a businessman, you become something else, you do it through the political structures, and even then it's going to be very difficult for you. In the United States, it is completely different. It is completely different nowadays. Bill Gates exercises a level of political power in the United States that no Russian businessman is able to in Russia today. And that
global
is
power.
Global political power. I mean, Bill Gates can change governments or can affect policies of governments in all sorts of places around the world. Jeff Bezos can, Soros can, all of these people can. There is no one like that in Russia now. I mean, we were talking about Soros and the way he was writing articles about Viktor Orban. You just don't see that happening in Russia anymore.
Well, they kicked out Soros, as did Orban.
Well, they did. They kicked him out. I mean, he's persona non grata in Russia.
Good move. Every government should follow that that example.
Well, absolutely. Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it is, if you like, I come back to this. It's the MAGA policy that Trump was trying to pursue in the United States and got some way towards achieving. I mean, we mustn't downplay how far Trump was able to move forward with that. But of course, Putin was able to take it an awful lot further, because unlike Donald Trump, Putin had the bureaucracy, Russia's deep state, because it does exist. They were supporting him, because they're not globalists either. That's a fundamental difference.
You know what Putin was? Now that you say it, it's interesting. Putin was like Trump and Michael Flynn in one.
Yes.
You know
yes.
Why I say that? Because if they didn't take out Michael Flynn, if Trump had Michael Flynn, he would have had the person that understood how the deep state works, how the intel agencies work, how DC works. So the team of Trump and Michael Flynn, I think would have done some amazing things for the America First agenda. Putin was kind of both of those people in one, in that he came from an intel background. He knew how the deep state in Russia worked. He knew how the swamp in Russia acted. Plus he had that Russia First, leadership quality.
Yes.
That Trump has. That was a difference. If they, it was such a critical, God, if you could go back in time and change one thing
yes.
about the Trump administration, it would yes. be how they got to Flynn. I think that move alone was absolutely pivotal to where we are today.
I completely agree. I entirely agree. And by the way, I think what you just said about Putin being Trump and Flynn in one is a brilliant point. It's exceptionally insightful, because if you actually look at what Putin did when he became president, and you look at how he knew exactly whom to appoint, he knew exactly who were the right people were. He knew where all the levers were. He knew how the intelligence system worked. He knew how the military system worked, because he had that internal knowledge. He had been not just within the intelligence community in Russia, but for a very long time. And he knew exactly how it worked and who the reliable people were. Because, by the way, there were an awful lot of people within the Russian deep state in the 1990s who were as compromised and as globalist as anyone in the United States deep state is now. But Putin knew how to counter them, because he had that inside knowledge. Donald Trump didn't have that knowledge. He depended on Michael Flynn. Flynn does have that knowledge, but they were very clever and tactically astute in going after Flynn. They separated Flynn from Trump, and Trump found that without Flynn, he was in problem. He was in trouble. That's a brilliant point, actually. It's never occurred to me before, but I think that explains a huge amount about the success in Putin's success in Russia, Trump's much more limited success in the United States. But, you know, let's be very clear about this. Trump thing is not played out, irrespective of what happens on the 20th of January. Donald Trump is still there. He's got tens of millions of people supporting him. He is perfectly capable of coming roaring back. In fact, if I was a gambling man, which I am not, I would put money on it.
And Flynn is back. Which is
yeah.
All right, let's get this up. Super chats from Brian, €10 super chat. Thank you very much, Brian from Flying Boar, $5 super chat. Update on Nord Stream 2.
Yes, well, actually, Putin talked about Nord Stream 2 in his press conference. He seemed very confident that it would be completed, and apparently work on it has actually restarted. They're actually laying pipelines. There's going to be more sanctions, more attempts to stop it, but I think it's a done thing. But can I just say, I think all this battle with Nord Stream 2 has soured the Russians completely from these kind of projects with the Germans in future. I don't think they're going to want to build more pipelines like that to Europe. Angela Merkel came along in 2015 and persuaded them to build Nord Stream 2 after they'd made a political decision that they weren't going to be able to build any more pipelines to Europe, and had just stopped South Stream, which was a pipeline to Europe that was going to go through Bulgaria. So they made that decision. Angela Merkel talked them round, persuaded them to start this project, Nord Stream 2 project, but I don't think they're ever going to do anything like that again. And I think if you're looking at the future of European energy policy, they need gas, they need natural gas from Russia if they're going to keep to their carbon targets and at the same time have energy to keep the European economy competitive. And I think with this one, they've completely messed up.
All right. Flying Boar update on Syria.
Well, I haven't heard very much from Syria. The last I heard, which was some time ago, is that the Syrian military have made considerable advances in Idlib province, and that the only part of Idlib province really that's basically still holding out is Idlib city, which is the capital, and a stretch of camps, let's call them refugee camps, along the Turkish-Syrian border, where a lot of jihadi fighters are entrenched. Apparently, there's been a major pullout by the Turkish military from Idlib province, and it looks as if even Erdogan has started to cut his losses there.
All right, let me find the super chat from Moonlight, from Moonswan Silverlight, £50 super chat.
Thank you. Oh, wow, thank you very much. Yeah.
I think it's incredibly cruel how they are pushing this climate change hoax. Some gullible people, children in particular, are really terrified that they don't have a future and get extremely emotional. The amount of lies being told is sickening.
Well, I'm going to make my one observation about this, which is, firstly, I agree. I think that people are being made very afraid by this. And of course, my wife is an academic. My niece is a student. And it's, you know, so I get a sense of what, you know, young people in universities think. And many of them are very frightened about climate change. And many of them are getting drawn into things like the Extinction Rebellion, which I find very strange and very bizarre and very concerning and, frankly, cultish. Some people may not be pleased with me about when I say that, but that's my own view about it. And I agree. I think that perhaps there's some concerns, but I'm sure that they are manageable. And I don't think there's any justification for this extraordinary panic that has been built up around this issue, which I would point out we've been hearing now for what, 20 years? 20 years about this? And, you know, life has still gone on much as it did before. I mean, we've not had, I mean, some winters have been warmer. We're going through a rather colder winter in London this year than we did last year. Changes in the climate, they're not so remarkable. So, you know, I am much more sanguine about this than I think it's the accepted thing to be. And I'm really rather worried. In fact, I'm very worried about how frightened some people have been made in ways which I think are unnecessary. And yes, I do think it is cruel to frighten people. Now, that's all I'm going to say. I'm not a scientist. I don't pretend to have a, you know, statistical understanding of this issue. But that's my impression overall.
Yeah, they're grooming people to have fear.
Absolutely. I mean, I know people who, I know young people who are being kept sleepless at night over it, which seems to me very strange.
Well, there's an agenda to having scared people, scared populace.
Absolutely. Yes.
All right. From Flying Boar, was Russia ever conquered by Romans or Alexander the Great?
No, no is the short answer. Alexander the Great never got that far. The Roman Empire did include Crimea, and the poet Ovid was actually exiled there. So Crimea and parts of what is now Ukraine, along the Black Sea. But if you're talking about the heartland regions of Moscow and those places, the Romans never got that far, and neither did Alexander the Great. The part of the former Soviet Union to which Alexander the Great did get was Uzbekistan, what is now Uzbekistan. And if you know your Greek history, a very, very famous incident involving Alexander took place in the city that is now called Samarkand, which was then called Marakanda, and where Alexander, in a furious rage, had a massive quarrel with his friend Clytus, and it ended in a fight in which Clytus was killed. So that's the closest Alexander ever got to Russia.
Yeah. From Dita Pogue, £5 super chat. Thank you very much for that. And from Edward Bernays, $4.99 super chat. No matter what kind of ist you are, Earth has finite resources. Everyone wants for economic growth. Finite resources versus economic growth leads to conflict.
Oh, that is very, very true. Though, of course, if you're the European Union, you pretend otherwise. I was reading one of their green New Deal, because the European Union also has a Green New Deal, by the way. In fact, which isn't widely known. And it was saying that, you know, after 2050, economic growth should continue without resources. It should become, it continue somehow without any exploitation of resources. And I'm trying to figure out how that is possible, because it doesn't make any kind of sense at all. But there is no doubt at all that there are only finite resources by definition. I don't think we're anywhere close to using them all up, but there are finite resources. And of course, the fact that resources are finite and more accessible in some places than in others explains why an awful lot of interstate and competition takes place, and why economic competition takes place. It explains why a country like Saudi Arabia is so important, because so much oil is there.
All right. That's, I think I got everything. All right. Great. Anything else you want to discuss, Alexander?
I will be very interested to see how the Biden-Russia thing plays out. As I said, I was surprised, actually, at how relaxed Putin seems to be about the prospects of a Biden presidency. I'm not suggesting that he is actually looking forward to it, but if anything, he seems to think that with Biden in the White House, of course, It's a question how long Biden will be in the White House. But with a Biden in the White House and with some of the other people around Biden, who, as I said, he pointedly said that the Russians also know, things might actually be easier for Russia than they have been under Donald Trump. That's a very interesting thought. And I wonder how it will all turn out. Bear in mind that actually Biden has said very little about Russia over the last few weeks. So he's had plenty of opportunity to talk strong and hard, but he hasn't actually said very much. So we'll see how it all plays out.
It's because they've got the laptop and more. All right. We have one more.
They've got far, far more than just a laptop.
Given what was going on in Ukraine, they've got it all. They've got it all. God knows what they have on Hunter. God knows. all right, let's start the super chat. And a couple of minutes, I'll just read the live stream, wrap it up at 5 o'clock. My time, 5 o'clock. Your time, 3 o'clock in London. Okay, from Flying Boar says, Putin is a guy, when he does something good, he looks good, but things he does sometimes that makes him look bad, for example, cozying up to Erdogan.
I agree. And by the way, if you want me to make a criticism about this press conference, there was one particularly bizarre moment when he was talking about, you know, how he gets on with various world leaders. And then he said, well, you know, the thing about Erdogan is that he's a man of his word. He's somebody you can absolutely rely upon. You know, when Erdogan says he's going to do something, it actually happens. And I mean, and it wasn't a joke, because Putin can be quite ironic sometimes, but it didn't give any impression of being any sort of joke. And I have to say, I mean, it struck me as a completely delusional comment. I mean, you know, what planet is Putin on when he talks about Erdogan? Because anybody could see that that isn't so. And he was again asked directly questions by a Russian interviewer about Turkey's role in the latest conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia and Turkey's role in the Caucasus. And I noticed that it was the one question that Putin evaded answering. He talked about, you know, what a good place Turkey is, but he didn't talk about that. I mean, very bizarre, very strange, and I mean, almost weird, actually. And it comes back to the kind of things that we've been discussing on this program, that Putin, who is by no means a flawless, perfect leader, he's you know, very strong in some things, not so strong in others. On Turkey, he's got a complete blind spot. He's still, I think, obsessed with this idea that he can win Turkey over, and that means that he's got to keep on good terms with Erdogan, even though Erdogan repeatedly bites Putin's hand as it feeds him.
All right, let me go through the live stream real quick, just for like a minute or two, just see what everybody's saying here. We'll wrap it up. From Spartan Warrior Queen says, she's speaking with Swan Silverlight, says, I follow the Great Reset Diet. You know about the Great Reset Diet, right, Alexander? Bugs.
Yes.
Just eat bugs. that's a great reset pot. We're going to be happy eating bugs. Yeah. All right. From White Rabbit says, Biden has already been compromised by the mayor of Moscow's wife, the ex-mayor of Moscow.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, that's what we know. Think about what we don't know. I'm sure there's an awful lot.
2.5 million. That's nothing. That's like a cup of coffee to them.
Absolutely.
Robert says, Merry Christmas. Let's see. Riff Garator, Trump won the election. Yes, Biden won't be president. All right. Let's see. Let's join Musk and live on Mars. Is there still a chance for Trump to win? Time seems to be running out. There's technically a chance.
Yes, I know. I mean, time is working, but you know, well, let's wait and see. Let's just wait and see. I mean, there is still time, is the short answer.
Tough.
But tough. Very tough.
Very tough. Absolutely. Let's see what else. I think there will be a Biden presidency, but it will be a very short-lived one. That's what Scott says.
I incline to agree. I think that's a spot-on analysis, actually.
Yeah, let's see. Phil says there's a shortage of turkey in the UK. Is that true?
Well, maybe. I don't eat turkey myself. I mean, I should say the only acceptable way to eat turkey is how some Americans do it, which is that they deep fry it. I mean, that is delicious, but you dare not do it in London because it's incredibly dangerous to try and do. I mean, I wouldn't even think of doing it. I mean, with our very built-up buildings and, you know, limited spaces. But I don't eat turkey, so I don't buy turkey. I haven't seen it. I don't know about that, but it wouldn't surprise me. Lots of things. I should say, by the way, before I continue, that Britain is in a bad way at the moment. I mean, we're going through a very severe economic crisis. We're back, you know, a third of the population of England is now back in lockdown. There's a Christmas has been cancelled. We can't fly to Europe. And of course, there's still uncertainties about what the Brexit situation is going to be. So it's not.
I'm hearing you speak, and it just really frustrates me. It seems to me like he put the nail in his coffin.
I rather think so too. Actually, I mean, there's been a massive backlash against him for the way this whole thing has been worked out. So, I mean, Britain is a bad way, and it's very depressing, and I'm very, very worried about Britain and my country where I live. And one hears an awful lot of people very worried and sad about it. I mean, it is troubling, and I hope things turn out better in the new year, but we'll see.
Klaus Schwab should really be in the next Bond movie as a villain. He is perfect. He is Klaus Schwab is the I mean, he is Dr. Evil. I mean, it's like they're not even hiding it. You know what I mean? It's like the globalists are like saying, who can we get to personify the perfect Bond villain as we move forward with the Great Reset?
Absolutely. I mean, it's almost as if, you know, he's auditioning for the role. In fact, he'd be the most brilliant Bond villain ever. I mean, running his own massive organization. I mean, you know, Spectre or Smersh or whatever it is.
Who was your favorite Bond?
Who was my favorite Bond? No question, Sean Connery was my favorite Bond. I mean, he was my first Bond, but I think he wipes all the others away, frankly. I don't think anybody has come close to being as good as Sean Connery was at Bond. By the way, I should say that, over the course of 2020, Britain lost two of its great stars, people who were hugely admired and loved by the British people. One was Sean Connery, and the other was Diana Rigg, who was famous in The Avengers with Patrick McNee, and who was also, in one of the Bond films on Her Majesty's Secret Service, where she played the one Bond girl that James Bond actually marries. So, we lost them both, and we're in mourning for both. So that's another thing that many British people are very sad about this year. But Bond villains, well, Mr. Schwab, I'm sure Eon Productions are waiting for your call.
It's a clown world. Stuff up. Let's do this two for chats, and we'll call it a day here. Hope there will be a day to talk about the control. We are involved in OTW, Russian interference in the USA in the 2016 bio war. By RIVM. The Dutch are involved in all kinds of stuff. We've talked about it many times.
Absolutely. Yeah. The Dutch are involved in all sorts of extraordinary things, which is very strange. When you go to the Netherlands, I mean, it's a very pleasant, well-run country. Why the Dutch get themselves involved in all these things, I really don't understand. But, you know, there we are. I mean, you know, I have nothing to add to that. And I agree.
Yeah, we'll focus more on stuff like that. Absolutely, Helma. Thank
absolutely.
You for that
super chat.
And from Flying Boar, update on India-China conflict in Ladakh area in Kashmir.
This is one of the things because when the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and all that was set up and the BRICS and all this, it was a lot of people thought that China and India were going to start getting together and becoming friends and would resolve all of these things. And one of the big surprises for me is how rapidly that has all fallen apart. Now, I understand that at the moment the situation on the border between India and China is relatively peaceful. But I understand that Indian opinion has hardened very much against China. And India, Prime Minister Modi, had a good relationship with Donald Trump. And India was sort of repositioning itself as an ally of the US. I would not be at all surprised if there's a Biden administration that gets closer to China, some of that momentum for a closer relationship between India and the US will slacken off. But on the conflict on the border itself, it seems to be quieter at the moment.
All right, we'll end it there. And we'll do some more live streams before Christmas, but thanks to everyone for their Christmas wishes as well. Thank you, Spartan Warrior Queen, for your awesome moderation. As always, we really appreciate it. The best moderator in all of YouTube. Oh, what's Flying Boar? One more super chat here. Indian media shows that Erdogan puts Syrian fighters in Pakistan-occupied Kashmir to fight Indian forces. If true, that's dangerous.
I wasn't aware of it. But if it is true, and it would not surprise me at all, it is extremely dangerous, given that the original jihadi movement, the real momentum towards international jihadism, began in precisely that part of the world, in the conflicts in Kashmir and Afghanistan, where obviously Pakistan is the bridge between the two, and where all kinds of organizations like the ISI, Pakistan Secret Service, was involved. So if Turkey and Erdogan are getting mixed up in all of that and are sending jihadi fighters there, then that is extremely dangerous and very worrying. And thank you for alerting us, and we will certainly look out for more news about it.
All right, cool. Good live stream, guys. We'll be on very, very soon to do some more lives, and have a great Monday. A good start to the week here, everybody. Yeah.